Welcome to the Revenue Lounge, a podcast for revenue operations professionals who want to understand the various facets of this important go-to-market function. In each episode, the team at Nectar interviews revenue warriors on how they are reimagining revenue operations in creative and disruptive ways, and what are their secrets to building a scalable and predictable revenue engine. Let's get started.
For years, B2B revenue teams have relied on traditional lead and MQL-based models to drive growth. But in today's complex buying landscape, where multiple stakeholders influence decisions, these old methods often fall short. Buyers aren't making decisions in isolation. They operate as a part of a group, evaluating solutions collectively. Yet many organizations still struggle to align their go-to-market strategies with this reality. Misalignment between marketing, sales, and customer success can lead to inefficiencies, stalled deals, and missed opportunities. The question is, how do you rewire your revenue motion to cater to buying groups instead of just individual leads? Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Revenue Lounge podcast. I am your host, Randy Likas. And in this episode, we'll dive into how to make the shift, the challenges involved, and the impact it can have on pipeline and revenue growth. And joining me today is Eric Cross. Eric is the Chief Revenue Officer at Reltio. He's a transformational leader with established success in developing and optimizing high-impact organizations across diverse revenue models. He's led the buying group transformation at Reltio and will be sharing his firsthand experience and lessons on the whole journey. Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Randy. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to the discussion.
Yeah, I do as well. So before we get into the buying group discussion and your journey and your transformation, I'd love to start a little bit before that. So if I understand it correctly, you have been at Reltio for 2.5, 3 years.
3 years.
3 years. And it was about 6 months in when you discovered that there might have been a problem. Can you talk a little bit about what that was?
Yeah, absolutely. Shortly upon joining, I think data is an asset for your organization. And when you're trying to do a level set to really understand what is the lay of the land, what's really happening in the business, I think the first thing you do is you want to go look at the data and get with your ops team and start looking for trends that are happening in the business. And it really came out very quickly for us is we had a very significant problem on two fronts. Number one is we were using a legacy kind of demand gen model that was more leads to MQLs, then it goes into pipeline, and then you hope that it turns into some type of opportunity. That was one. And then the second was is what we found within our sales process, we were evaporating 35-40% of our pipeline once it got into pipeline. So if you just think of easy math, if you have a 5-6 stage sales process, as normally happens, your stage one is further qualification, mm-hmm. and then you cycle it through. In our first two stages, we were evaporating 35-40% of our pipeline down the road within a 3-4 month period. And so the problem statement around that is you were creating a false sense of security of how healthy your pipeline was. And so that really was the genesis for us looking at, do we need to do things differently? It was pretty simple. That was the major problem statement we had.
When you realized that there was the problem and you started to rally the team together, how did you go about that? How did you get the proper alignment across different functions?
Sure.
And that would be the first question. The second question is, like, you know, as you thought about moving away from a model that was working or not, was being done for years, you probably had to go convince the board, right, that this is a different way. So I'd love to understand the alignment with your team, right?
Sure.
Your cross-functional team, as well as like with the board.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, I think most importantly, at least in our case, there needed to be a shift. If you look how most enterprise SaaS vendors operate, the functions tend to be siloed to a certain degree. And if you think about sales and marketing, most companies, sales is pointing the finger at marketing, marketing's pointing the finger at sales. It's, we don't own the combined function between the two. And so in our case, I had to make that mind shift with the leadership team and the broader organization that we're not going to refer to things as sales and marketing. We're one team, and we're going to refer to it as the go-to-market organization. And with the mindset that sales owns marketing and marketing owns sales, right? I just think that's a level set you need to do because that eliminates a lot of the background noise and a lot of the consternation, a lot of the finger pointing. So that's how we really started with it. The second point, at least from how we approached it, was we had some ideas. I was talking with our CMO at the time in terms of the problem statement. What do we need to do about it? We were very well aware of ABX and how a lot of organizations were starting to adopt this. It was in its infancy. So we pulled the leadership team together. We went and did a day and a half offsite We effectively locked everybody in a room for 2 days. And we said, this is the problem statement. These are the options we have in terms of how we need to re-architect or reorganize the business in terms of our demand gen motion. And we gave everybody a heads up in advance of the meetings. Come prepare. You don't need slides. 3 to 5 bullet points, problem statement, recommended actions, and then a solution that you think is the best fit. And then we just dialogued around it for a day and a half. I will say this, it wasn't just the sales and marketing leadership. We brought customer success into it. We brought product management into it. We brought a number of the field marketing leaders into it. And so we wanted to make it a decision criteria that was a company decision, not a sales and marketing decision. Mm-hmm. So that was really the second thing that we did. And it really, it's just you have to have an open collaborative environment and debate the heck out of the issues. Because you get a lot of ups and downs over a day and a half. But really the North Star you're truly really trying to point towards is we're going to walk out of this meeting in 2 days and we will have a decision and we will move forward. And it's okay to disagree, but you have to commit. But we are not going to walk out unaligned. And we're going to deliver a kind of an execution model in terms of how we're going to go about it. And we're going to go all in on it. We're not going to pilot it.
Yeah.
And that was really a core tenet from my perspective, which really had the most pushback was this is a fundamental shift for the organization. Should we really go all in? My experience has been anytime you do a pet project or a pilot, it's typically not that successful. And the reason is when you say, oh, we're going to test it, the broader organization says, we're not committed. Yeah. It's just an exercise. I don't really have to buy in. I don't have to modify behaviors and actions. And so we just made that fundamental kind of mind shift for everyone that it's all in or we're not going to do it.
You burn the ships, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of risk with that. So that's how, at a general level, how we brought the kind of the leadership team together to start that motion. In terms of buy-in from, let's say, the board or the CEO staff level, I looked at them very differently. If you look at the board level, we meet every 90 days for a board meeting, and we have a checkpoint with them in the middle of the quarter that's typically virtual. But there's always a section I have in terms of these are key priorities and focus areas for us over the next 6 to 9 months. And so it's more of just an awareness function for them in terms of we're going in this direction. Here's the problem statement. Here's the change we're going to make. And then this is how we're going to measure the outcome of it. And typically the board's not there to tell you how to do your job. They're there to advise, give counsel, different point of view on things. Their function solely is really, hey, how do we help keep you out of the ditch as an organization? So that was a pretty easy conversation. I think with CEO staff, there was a little bit of, you've got to get buy-in in the sense of you don't tell people this is what we're going to go do. You similar kind of construct to with the board, but you have to bring CEO staff along with you in terms of why you're doing it. What the risks are, what are the upsides as it relates to it. And it's more of a conversation and a short presentation just so that everyone is aligned.
Yeah.
Because you're not looking for them to say yes. You're looking for them to have understanding, to give you a point of view in terms of why you should do it or why you should not do it. But ultimately, the decision really resides with the senior leaders that sit within sales and marketing. And so we check the box there. Funny story, I told Manish, our CEO, I said, look, this is either going to work or it's not. And I said, it's high risk, but we have to do it. It's so core and so important for the business. And if it doesn't work, jokingly, I said, you're probably going to be looking for another CRO because it will be a very bad decision. But I had a lot of conviction around it, and we got the leadership team to buy into it.
Yep.
And we all went it all in and then got into execution mode.
What I love about how you guys did it, and so think about, there's this buying group motion that's being talked about a lot in the marketplace right now, which is what you all did, or opportunity-based marketing motion. And there's a lot of people who are leaning in and very interested in it, but there's a hesitation to make the commitment. And the early adopters, you being one of them, are approaching it different ways. A lot of them are doing it in smaller pilots, but you guys went all in. And that's how you're different than the early adopters. But you are championing the results, which I think we're on this seismic shift of the way that go-to-market is going to be working in the future. And so I love the fact that you guys went all in on that. I'm curious, though, you talked about ABX, but ABX is different than an opportunity-based marketing motion, right? There's a lot of similarities, but there's some differences there. And so I'm just curious, is the idea born to go with an opportunity-based marketing motion? Did you have an experience with others? Was it part of the working with some of the analyst firms? I'm curious, where the idea was born.
Yeah, great question. I'm going to break this up into two parts. The first one really goes to the why we even embrace it, and then I'll speak to who we leverage as third-party resources to help guide us on that. If you look at in today's world with the ubiquity of information and what the buying journey looks like for most enterprise buyers, it's very similar regardless of what market category you serve. If you're an enterprise SaaS, the buying motion is pretty typical. Buyers, their intent is to remain anonymous as long as possible before they have to engage with you.
Yep.
And in the buying motion today, most organizations, they're 60 to 70% already through the direction they ultimately think they're going to go long before they embrace you or they lean into you and they engage. And so if you think about it in that construct, this legacy model of we're just going to produce a bunch of raw leads. We're going to have an SDR organization that's going to call on these leads, ask a few questions. If it meets a criteria, then we flip it to the sales team and then they work it. All right. Well, if you look at it that way, you can see that doesn't really marry into how people actually buy and lean in. So what's most important is you need to reach individuals before they engage with you. Entice them to lean into you, right? And so one way you do that is you need intent signals. Right? You need to leverage AI, you need to leverage intent-based marketing signals out of your technology stack, and we have a very mature technology stack. And so from our perspective, it was really about, let's reach the people that count. Let's not count the number of people we reach, right? That's the old model. It's like, yep. Oh, we're going to produce 10,000 leads, and we know this percentage will turn into opportunities. That's like, doesn't work anymore. It's like, reach the people that are meaningful and that matter.
Yep.
Right. And so that was the core tenet. Second is, if you think about how most organizations buy, it's a team. It's a buying team. And so this is where the importance of understanding your ideal account profile, your ideal customer profile, the buyer personas that you serve, the tailored messages that fit into each of those buyer personas really, really matters. Because if you're able to reach them and you deliver a value prop or a message that's specific to what they want, then they're typically going to lean in quicker than they would otherwise. And then you can establish a point of view, because we all know that if you have first mover advantage and you can set the table and guide the customer in terms of how to think about it, you've got a leg up on your competition. So that was super important. It was really just buying into leaning into the buying motion that really exists in enterprise software today.
Yeah.
And in our instance, like in the ABX motion, we leveraged Forrester Group because they were really the pioneers around this.
Mm-hmm.
And go back to what I said earlier when we did the go-to-market offsite with the leadership team. I brought Forrester in the second day. Once we got to a point of critical mass, we thought this might be the right thing. And then we had them spend a half a day with us and really guide us, give us perspective on how we're thinking about it. Are we on the right path? Make recommendations, et cetera, and so forth. So they spent a half a day with us. And a lot of good things came out of that. We tweaked a few things here and there. But they were a great thought partner for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were off to the races.
So many things you said there, I think, are just spot on. One is the buying process and experiences change, right? People are, they don't need to talk to salespeople right out of the gate. They can do enough of their own research, talking to analysts, talking to their peers, where they're getting about 70% of the way through their own journey before they ever want to engage in sales. So that's a huge problem that you recognize. The other one is, I think the traditional model that so many companies are still operating out of, which is have BDRs call or somebody attends a webinar, like asking for 30 minutes, those playbooks are just not working any longer because we're in this period of what we call the great ignore, right? People are just the mass automation and spamming of automated messages. You probably get 20, 30 of these a day, right? And you can spot them a mile away and you just ignore them. And so just getting people to engage is super, super hard. So 100% agree with you there. I have a question for you about the alignment piece, because I did hear you say that the easy part was aligning the leaders, the cross-functional leaders. The hard part was the people who are doing it day to day, right? Getting them to change. So I'm curious to hear whether it was with the cross-functional leaders at the beginning or whether it was the people that are in the trenches and own the numbers. What were the common objections that you heard?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would tell you, that's kind of the last mile construct of what you really have to knock down is getting buy-in. I think there's a couple of things. As I said, the leadership team embraced it. We did two things. First of all, let me say this. If you're going to execute on any type of initiative as it relates to, let's talk about the sales organization, I think the most critical element that you have is your first line sales leadership team. Because they are the ones that are going to enable the right behaviors. Mm-hmm. And typically what you find is if you're getting the right behaviors, that's because they're coaching it. If you're getting the wrong behaviors, your first line leadership team is typically allowing that behavior to happen.
Yep.
Right? Because the sales leadership team is a reflection of the actions and the behaviors of their team. So what we ended up doing was we took our frontline sales leaders, and then we created these pods of our sales team. We put them into teams of 3 to 5. And over a 3-week period, we just did, I'll call it a thought experiment. Went to the sales organization, said, hey, we need a thought partner. We're thinking about this. We want to bring you in. We defined an agenda, what they needed to be prepared to speak with, and let them poke holes in it. Because the whole reason you do it that way, and I'm not saying you have to do it that way, that's just the way we did it, because they ultimately have to own it. And if they feel like they have a stake in the decision-making and the strategy that the company is ultimately going to make,
yeah,
then that is just, that's assumed ownership at that point. And so we went through that over a kind of a 2 to 4 week period. And these were the common objections we got. One, and this will not surprise you, and this is typically your long tenured sales people that have always made their number and they've been doing this for 20 plus years. It's, Eric, I just want a BDR to get me meetings. That's all I need. And then I'll take it from there and I'll figure out how to close it. All right. And so that was the number one objection. The second objection was, I don't really want to change. I mean, they didn't say it that way, but that was typically the undercurrent that we would hear is, I've got a formula and a playbook for success.
Yep.
And that's my intellectual property, and I'm held accountable to a goal, and I should be able to go run my business the way I want to run it. All right. So those were the two main objections. The way we overcame it was with data. I would tell you this, it was the 80-20 rule. 80% of the people really leaned into it, 20% were the Eeyores, right? Yeah. Oh, shucks, this is bad type of thing. And what we did is we just produced data at an individual level and said, okay, and most of these people have been here long tenured, 3+ years. And we showed them data at the individual level in terms of what was really happening and things that pulled in the pipeline and what their conversion rates were, and they were very low. And I'm like, yes, you may be making your number, but I mean, you're converting less than, you know, 20% of your pipeline. So like, that's a problem statement and we need to go solve for it. You need to get on board. So we went through that exercise 2 to 4 weeks. I would be remiss if I did not say this. Did we have one or two people that just would not get on board with it? Absolutely. And that was a cancel out scenario.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Because in today's world, look, individual contributors are individual contributors. They're focused on themselves, making, overachieving their plan, making as much money as they can. And you really need altruism in their behavior and actions. And that's very hard to drive towards. Why a lot of people never want to go into leadership positions is because they just want to worry about themselves. And so for us, we had to try to help shift individuals to think, look, the what you do is selling, overachieving plan. The how you do it is even more important. Right. And that's what leans into like altruistic behaviors, being a part of something larger than yourself, being mindful of, yes, I have to do what's right for me, but I also need to do it in the best interest of the company. And you've probably heard this before. It's like best in class is when you can marry what's right for the individual with what's right for the organization. If you get people to buy into that,
yeah,
it eliminates background noise and you can really achieve things that you never thought you could achieve.
Yeah. So we'll get into some of the results in a little bit, but I also think that, you know, once you started seeing some of these improvements that you guys started to see, that probably changed a lot of minds very quickly, right? No, a sales rep wants to work as efficient as possible. If you're working 10 leads and one of them converts, like that's a lot of work. If you can now change that where I don't have to work as hard, but I'm getting better results, you're going to get people on board pretty quickly with that.
Look, I mean, here's the other thing. The technology is a big part of it. And so I would say there was a third issue the AEs had, which was, I'm not clear on like, how are we going to measure this intent signals and drive that motion forward? And so what we did, we leveraged our 7 or 8 different tech platforms, but we built an ABX dashboard for every BDR and AE. And so we work off of a named account model plus some territory for non-named accounts. So we market to 100% of those accounts. So an AE, we show the AEs and the BDRs, like you're gonna come in every Monday morning, you're gonna pull up your dashboard, and you're gonna see every account that you have ownership to, and it will show the intent signals that are being delivered, which, oh, by the way, it's not 100% accurate, but it's about 70% accurate, because it's a measurement of how they're interacting with you, but also what they're doing outside of you,
right,
in terms of measuring those signals. And it basically scores it. And the scoring mechanism says that once it gets above a certain number value, it's like they're doing research, there's a high probability that they are interested in what you have to offer. They have a business problem. You need to engage with them now type of scenario. And so once we showed that to the broader organization, the individual contributors, light bulb moment, they were like, wow, we've never had anything like this before, because it's all about visibility and really zeroing in on that. And that was a big needle mover for us.
I think what you're seeing probably with a lot of that intent is they're going to buy. Whether they buy from you or not is a different question, right? But you're seeing enough to show that there's a swarming going on in the account right now with multiple people. There's an initiative that's about to go underway or maybe is under. Okay, so before we get into the execution piece of it, I have one more question for you on what your hypothesis was on what the benefits were going to be. Because you said, like, this was a risk, right? And we might end up needing to look for a new CRO. So going into this, before we actually started, what did you see as, like, the size of the prize? Was it, we're losing 40% pipeline now, we want to bring it, was it a reduction in lost pipeline, or was it a revenue metric? Just curious how you thought about that.
Yeah, no. So I think there's a couple of things. For individuals that may not understand, how do you define as an organization before you're going into a fiscal year? You know what your target's going to be on the year. The operating plan gets set at the board level. And what cascades out of that is you need to produce a certain amount of pipeline in order to support that goal you're going to go after, right?
Yep.
And you base that number off of historical conversion metrics, et cetera, and so forth. And so I looked at the prior 2 or 3 years in terms of what went back and did a historical view, and we weren't producing enough pipeline to support the bookings goal. Forget about whether we made the plan or not. And so I looked at it and said, the gold star for us is we need clarity around what gets into pipeline. So once it gets there, like you're an in-quarter view or a six-month view, and you pretty much know, like, if you, number one, if you believe that it's real, all right, you can apply some just basic metrics off of historical conversion rates by stage, and you can, we got it very lasered in where we could pinpoint within 5 to 7 percentage points of where we were going to land on a quarter.
Wow.
Not just the current quarter, but looking out current quarter plus one, just based off of that. So that was the gold star for us, is let's get the noise out of the pipeline, the things that aren't real, because we're going to need to go re-architect the amount of pipeline we really need to generate.
Yep.
You've heard this. Pipeline is not like fine wine. It does not age well. Right? It just doesn't.
Yeah.
And so I looked at it in two parts. Number one is if you think about pipeline, so that's sales is taking it, there's a there. And in our case, we set very high criteria in the ABX motion that said, once we do all the things where we're getting intent signals, we get them to lean in and engage, we try to do a couple of things. Number one is we have to establish budget authority, need, and timing somewhat, right? Like, they have to be able to articulate how they're thinking about it, whether they've formulated a project team or not. You're not going to have 100% of all of that. But what we found just looking at history was is if somebody could actually define that for us, like, we were like, okay, there's a there. That was part one. Part two was is, and this was specific to Reltio, our successes, there were always a minimum of 3 buying team members that were engaging.
Yep.
And so the second threshold for us was, if you establish goals, authority, need, and timing, somewhat have a good idea on that, and you have 3+ buying team members, at that point it goes into pipeline, okay? And so here's what it did for us. Our conversion, once it hit qualification, which is our stage one, where we were having 35-40% fallout, we reduced that, and I know we did a session with Forrester a year or so ago, but if you look at, like, current metrics, we've reduced our fallout of pipeline by 60%.
Wow.
Which is amazing. So when something is in pipeline because of the high bar, like, we know it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And we know something's going to happen, and typically timing is the only thing that kind of moves things around. So that was one. The second is, if you look at our pipeline conversion and pipeline velocity as an output from this motion, our average close time was reduced. Initially, it was like 10%. We just finished our fiscal year, and I was actually doing a look back. I want to say we had 22-23% improvement in terms of sales cycle time. So we've reduced our close time.
Yeah.
And that was a major benefit for us. But it also, when we go into a quarter, everybody says you need 3x coverage. I've never understood why people say that, because that is a function of how healthy and real is that pipeline. If you've got 3X coverage and you don't have a high bar in terms of the reality of it, that may not be enough.
Yes.
And in our case, we know, and this would shock a lot of revenue leaders, if I go into a quarter and I've got 2 to 2.5X coverage on my in-quarter pipeline, I actually feel pretty good.
Yeah.
Because I know The majority of it's already going to be later stage. We've already stress tested with a customer. We know there's a there. We've identified budget authority need, timing, and even risk at that point. And we know it's going to close at some point. It may not close in the current quarter, maybe the next quarter.
Yeah.
But it just gives you comfort that what is in there is real.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're looking out 6 to 12 months, because that motion still applies, you start getting a sense of 9, 10, 11 months down the road, are you going to have a problem? Are things moving? Is the velocity of the pipeline going in the direction you want it to go? And then here's the last point I would say, and I don't know that I could draw a direct correlation between this and our ABX motion, but, and I just reviewed this the other day, our average selling price is up 20%.
Wow.
In a very tough macro environment over the last 2 years.
Yep.
And, so and what average time to close, our average time to close has decreased more than 20%. Our average selling price is up more than 20%. And then our competitive win rates are best in class. I don't want to specifically say what our conversion rates are, because if a competitor listens to this, but we win a high majority of the business that's in our pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, incredible results. I want to talk about the implementation piece next. Yep. So help me understand in terms of calendar. So when you did your summit, when you brought everybody together, around what month of year was this?
May.
Okay. Of 2022?
2023.
Okay.
Hey, it was one or the other. I think it was 2023. I could be wrong, because that would be almost 2 years from now. I think it was 2023, but I'll stay corrected if somebody says it was 2022.
The more important question, where I'm going with this, is May, and then you moved really, really quickly. When did you launch? Like, how long did it take you all to launch?
You're not going to believe this. It was 60 days.
Wow.
And here's how we broke that up. There were three buckets. There was design planning was phase one, development testing phase two, production launch measurement phase three. So we worked it that way. I think the design planning really started. The most of that was done when we did the go-to-market offsite.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we transitioned to develop and test, that was where you had to make sure we had the targeted personas identified and we believed in them. We had all of made sure that our account lists, prospect lists were accurate. We re-architected definitions around what happens in pre-pipeline funnel to fit into our ABX criteria. And then we had to do a lot of modification around the tech stack. We run pretty much every flavor of what you can do, but it was primarily Sixth Sense, Sales Loft, Outreach. And so we worked with each of those vendors, just helping us with defining the business processes and how to think about it.
Yeah.
So that was development and test. And then we did do, even though I said we went all in, and this was a debate point, was should we take one region and just go ahead and start them early on it, so we start getting some signals of what's working and what's not. And we did that. We didn't publicize it to the broader organization. We just we had a sales leader that was really leaning in the central and western U.S., and it was his idea. He goes, why don't I just go ahead and start this with my team? He goes, they're bought into it. We're probably going to get kicked in the face, but let's try to get some learnings while we're getting to the 60-day. We're going live with it. And so we did that, and we didn't get a lot of surprises out of it, but we saw benefit very early on. And I think the last point is it actually strengthened the relationship between our SDR, BDR organization and the AEs.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you're both getting up in the morning and you're looking at the same dashboard, and then you can decision around, okay, Tom or Sally, BDR, it's like these 15 accounts are showing signals, right? And sometimes they identify who they are, sometimes they don't, which is fine.
Yeah.
But I was like, you take these seven, I'll take these seven. Let's take the next 5 days and let's try to build some momentum out of this. And the second point I'll say is we actually brought partners into this mix as well. So if you think about buying team members, because we're very centric on global SIs and boutique partners, we pull them into the motion as well, made them a buying team member.
Yep.
And that was a big benefit for us as well. But yeah, it was three phases and it was 60 days.
That's incredible.
Went live. And then we brought Forrester back in, 45 days later. We just showed them the results, talked through some of the challenges, made a few tweaks here and there. And it's been a benefit for us. I will say this, the last thing, I didn't mention this earlier, and this was more of an output after we executed and had some tenure with the program, is we built a go-to-market revenue council, which was a small group of, it wasn't just leaders. We had a couple of AEs, a couple of solution consultants, one person from CE, somebody from demand gen on marketing that we created a, we call it an offering team that would meet once every 6 weeks and review the data, review results, getting feedback from what's happening positively, what's happening that we need to improve upon, and made that a very small offering team. And then I would do a staff call once a month with the broader leadership team, and we'd bring them in and they would say, okay, here are the findings, here are some tweaks we need to make, so forth and so on. Because I think with any strategy that you have, it's got to be an ongoing process that's continually changing. If you think about your enablement program, a lot of people are like, oh, we did the enablement, we're done. It's like, it's not an event, it's an ongoing process, and it changes and adapts and evolves over time.
So in that 60 days, and you had those three different parts of that process, what was the hardest part, would you say?
I mean, I think it was all hard. It's not in the sense of we didn't know what to do. I think when you, any sea change moment that you have, when especially around a shift in strategy, there's typically not a day that goes by that there's not some level of disappointment. And looking back on it, I think the biggest learning for me was I'm very data oriented. We had a lot of pushback from the AEs, roughly 20% of them, that just weren't really wanting to buy in. And like I said, we produced data for them. I probably could have been more granular in terms of the data elements to weave the story in the direction I needed it to go. I'm being a little bit harsh on myself, but I think the way we approached it was right. We had a handful of situations where it was just like we had to mandate it. And I don't think that is a great outcome. That's not leadership. That's a little bit of being a dictator. It says, hey, we're doing it. No questions asked. And sometimes there's a place for that. But I think there are some things we could have done differently to massage some of the individuals to really get on board with it. But that was probably it.
Okay.
It was very smooth. I think the other important element is in why it worked for us. I had a very strong partnership with marketing, and the leadership team in both sales and marketing were very tightly integrated.
Yeah.
And everybody took ownership, and everybody was willing to live in a penalty-free zone. Like I've always said, you get a collection of people when you're trying to drive a different strategy. Not everybody's going to participate at the same level you need them to, and there's always great ideas, and a lot of times people are just not comfortable sharing it because, you know, it's counter to or opposite of what they think the conventional wisdom is.
Yeah.
We had the benefit that I had very seasoned, tenured leadership team that kind of viewed it like we live in an open garden. If I have an idea, I'm going to share it. It's a penalty-free zone. I'm not going to be penalized for it. And I think that was probably one of the biggest assets we had that eliminated any background noise. Everybody got on board for the most part.
Having hindsight as being the benefit here, what would you have done differently?
When I look at the buying motion, there were some tweaks and variances between the buying motion in Europe versus North America that I knew and I was aware of. I didn't give it as much credence as I should have. We took feedback from the European team, agreed with them, didn't make some of the tweaks we needed to. And what we found ourselves is we got, after we went live 60 days, I'd say it was probably 90, 120 days later, we did tweak some things in terms of how we approached it with the European team. So I would say we got a half start with them. But looking back, I'm not saying we didn't have belief that they did have some variance. I was probably a little cavalier in terms of acknowledging it and making the modification. But we got there.
Yeah.
And we got there very quickly. But I would just say that, and I think it goes to my point earlier in terms of getting into the granularity of the data.
Yeah.
Like, if I had really looked at it more closely, I probably would have come to that kind of conclusion and been in agreement with how they were thinking about it versus it having to be 120 days later. But again, we did this so fast that within 4 months, it was running smoothly.
One of the things that we often hear, so alignment is probably the hardest part, getting the proper alignment. Sounds like you guys did really well with that because of the way that you approached it. But the second challenge we often hear is we don't have good data, right? So if you look at like our opportunities have like one person on them. We don't have a good understanding what that buying committee was because sales reps are just not good at updating people that kind of come in and out of a deal. And so as we think about what are the different personas that we need to have involved, at what point of engagement do they have to have? Like, they don't have that. Now, you guys are a data unification company, so maybe it was easier for you to.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I would tell you that. I mean, this is not a plug for Reltio. I think we did have the benefit of we drink our own champagne. I mean, we're a data management platform. In essence, and this is a challenge for any software company, any organization, like they don't have trusted and unified data.
Yeah.
Right? So we had the benefit we could leverage our own technology because we've got 15, 20 different systems that have data that resides in them.
Yeah.
And so we leverage our own technology to stitch that all together in a graph fashion so that not only did it say, okay, this prospect's who they are, but we could see all the hierarchical relationships pulled out of other systems in terms of, okay, you know, this is the activity that they've had with us over the last 3 years. If it's an installed customer, these are the entitlements, et cetera, and so forth. So we were able to get a complete view of that and then feed that into our downstream system so that we knew we had clean and trusted data. But that is a problem for a lot of people. But again, set aside Reltio being a platform that can solve for that for companies, I do think this, and this is where product marketing and product management have to really work together, is how you bring those two together. If you think about the buyer personas, the ideal customer profiles, et cetera, and so forth, all the data elements that matter to you in terms of how you shape, in terms of what you're going to go do out in the marketplace, I think, and this is advice I would give if you're a software company, is if you don't feel like your data is in a readiness state, go hire a couple of college interns
that
go on a 6-week exercise just to clean all that up. It would be manually intensive. Do not try to do it inside of your RevOps function. That's not strategic. They like go hire some consultants, have them do the cleanup work over 4 to 6 weeks, and then you'll be the better for it.
Yeah. Two more questions, and I'm sorry about cognizant of time, but what are the metrics that change, right? So MQLs and individual leads in the old world don't matter in this new world. It's probably about opportunity creation, I would imagine, and then obviously revenue. But I'm curious, like the metrics that you're measuring how are they different than what they were before you made this change?
Yeah, I'm going to put it in two buckets. It's pipe quality and pipe velocity. Those are the most meaningful metrics. And so for us, pipe quality is, are we seeing an increasing volume of opportunities once they get into stage one that will ultimately convert into stage two? Mm-hmm. So that was most important for us, because if you think about, we have a 5-stage sales process. First stage is qualification. We talked about the high criteria to even get to that point, right? There's still some qualification that has to happen, right? And so for us, it was like, historically, before we pivoted this motion, we'd have garbage in coming into qualification. 10% would ever get to, 10 to 20% would get into discovery, and then it may not get out of discovery. And that's where that 35, 40% was falling out with stage one and stage two. So for us, we just measured and said, what would be best in class in terms of conversion from qualification to discovery? And Forrester worked with us on this and set the bar of what it should be. And I want to say it was 28% or something like that. So that was like the KPI. It's like, are we seeing that as a result?
Yeah.
And we did. And you know, we've maintained consistency with that, because we know if it gets to discovery, I can put an equation on it and I can tell you what's going to happen within 5 to 7%, right? Yeah. It's a great place to be.
It is.
But it also scares you too, because if you're looking out, you're like, wow, Houston, we have a problem. Like, we've got to really produce more pipeline. So there's that. That's the kind of the quality piece. I think the other piece on quality is if you think about pre-pipeline. So for us, we didn't really talk about this, but everybody manages a forecast, right? You focus on the pipe velocity, how much new pipeline's going into the sales teams. Most people don't look at pre-pipeline. Like we run a monthly forecast on what's happening pre-pipeline. So for us in the ABX motion, you've got interest is the first criteria, which is like there's something going on out here. They haven't revealed themselves. Then there's engagement. And so that's when we start seeing that, okay, we're getting multiple people starting to engage with us, whether it's anonymous, whether it's through some type of digital means, or they're a hand raiser, whatever it is.
Yep.
And then the last step before it moves into pipeline is called prioritized. And so for us, that's where it's minimum 3 buying team members. We've established goals, authority, need, and timing. And most companies don't look at it this way. You want to know if you're going to have a problem down the road, 9 to 12 months, really track what's happening in that last mile before it goes to pipeline in terms of what goes into prioritized. And so for us, like Forrester gave us the metric, it says a best-in-class metric is if 22% of what gets into prioritized, if it ultimately converts into pipeline, that's a best-in-class metric. For us, we're at 35-40%.
Wow.
Right? So if you want to know, are you going to have a problem 9-12 months down the road? If you're seeing velocity in terms of what's rolling in to prioritized and you're getting that kind of movement,
yeah,
you're going to be okay, because we already know the metrics in terms of what percentage is going to convert. And then we know once it gets into pipeline, within 5 to 7 points, we can pinpoint what, you know, how much of this is going to close at some point in the future. And so it's a great barometer for what's going to happen 9-12 months down the road. And it eliminates the hockey stick. You have a great quarter, now we suck. Great quarter, now we don't.
Right.
So that's the quality piece. And then I think the last piece is just the velocity. How fast are deals moving through each stage of the sales process? And so we have 5 stages. It depends on stage, but what I would tell you is we've seen improvement on the velocity of pipeline. As I said, our average time to close is down over 20%.
Yeah.
And so we've seen improvement across all of those. Like I'll just tell you, I'll give this metric. I don't care if our competitors hear it or not. We get like into a late stage opportunity, like midpoint of the sales cycle, or you're doing the proof of concepts, you've got executive sponsorship, you got alignment with partners, we'll close 90% of it.
Wow.
But again, like those sound like great numbers. We eliminated all the background noise.
Right?
It's like this 3 to 5X coverage. Yeah, coverage matters. It's about how healthy of that pipeline is it? And do you have a true understanding of it? Because if they're not going to make a decision, you said this earlier, can they buy from us or can they buy from anybody? Like, that's what you want in your pipeline. They're going to go take action.
Yeah.
And then it's our job to convince them of why we're a better solution than somebody else.
You want to hear something crazy, Eric? I had a conversation with a revenue leader last week that they told me that they are looking for 8 times pipeline coverage right now. What does that tell you? That tells you that there's a lot of garbage going into that, right? Because if it was that easy to get 8 times coverage, why wouldn't we do it? There's a problem that needs to be solved other than we have to do more.
Well, yeah, Nat, I would say this. If you think you need 8X coverage, you probably need to do some work on defining what pipeline is.
Yeah.
That's right. I've been in this business 20 plus years, and I've been with a handful of high-flying companies. I've never seen a need to have 8X coverage on pipeline. But again, it goes back to how do you define what it is? Exactly. What is the criteria that you establish in order for something to actually be worthy of us investing time?
Yes.
Look, let me just say this. Here's a core tenet I've always had. You know, I think you can tie this into the ABX motion. When something is going to convert into pipeline, like especially if you're in the first stage, your goal should be, how do I qualify out? Mm-hmm. Like, you need that customer to convince you of why you should invest and orchestrate a number of resources over a 6 to 8 month period.
Yeah.
Like, convince me of why it's a good use of my time. And when you set a very high bar with your ABX motion, before it gets there, it eliminates that issue. But I'm like, qualify out. Don't try to figure out how to qualify in. Figure out how to qualify out.
Yep.
Because you go spend 7 months on something that ultimately was never going to get there, you just burned 7 months of sales capacity.
That's right. What's that opportunity cost, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
100%.
So one question I had was the handoff between BDRs and AE. So you talked about 3 qualified buying committee members, and you talked about BANT, right? The BANT criteria. Is that something that the SDR/BDR has to do before they pass over? At what stage does it get passed over?
No. Great question. So like this whole effort required a re-architect of our sales process, the entry and exit criteria, both pre-pipeline and pipeline. So we did that work. I should have said, like, that was the final output of what we did coming out of the go-to-market summit once we were all in agreement. We had to do some of that work. So that was one. The second is we built into Salesforce, I don't want to call it the KPIs, but all of the metrics and information data elements we need around budget authority, need, and timing. Like, we use MedPIC, so we re-architected that to fit into this motion. And so it was a single pane of glass. So a BDR and an AE both have access to that same account or opportunity record. And so it was automatically done, like the input there, and then everybody had it. So we didn't really have any issues there. And I will say this, the one thing you always do see this, every now and again, we'll have an AE that's like everything's been done, but they just will not accept it. And we solved that very simply where we just would reassign it and to a different AE. If you don't want to work it, fine, we'll give it to someone else. And we did that twice, and then we didn't have an issue after that.
It's amazing what that'll do.
I mean, it's a behavior change. And it's like I said earlier, you're either coaching the behavior or allowing it to happen. And I wasn't going to allow it to happen. I was like, you know what? It was a teaching moment.
Yeah. I talked about this earlier where I think there's just a lot of people who are showing interest and they're leaning in, but they haven't made that jump. What advice would you give to leaders who are at that stage where they know that there's a better way? They know that the existing way is broken, but there's risk and they're not sure how to go about it. What are the two or three recommendations you might make?
Well, and this goes back to something I said earlier. I think the most important thing is if the first step to recovery is recognizing you have a problem, don't suffer in silence. Bring a collective group of leaders to the table and have a working session. You can say it's a thought exercise. But get everybody to lean in and be on board. Get in the boat with you, number one.
Yep.
Because look, being a CRO, every role in every software company is very hard and challenging at times. I would say that for anybody that's a revenue leader, whether you're the CRO, whether you're a first line leader, don't paddle the boat by yourself. Like, get people in the boat with you, mm-hmm. and then decision around that. Because if you make mistakes or bad things come out of it as an output, there's collective ownership.
Yep.
That would be the first thing. And I think the hardest is getting marketing on board, because reality is, and this is not about our people, but every organization lives this, marketing is going to look, their operational function, they're going to look at the data set that they want to, and it's human nature to shape that data set to perpetuate the vision or the answer that you want. Same thing happens in sales. And so get everybody in the boat, settle on a common set of metrics and data elements that matter, and get everybody to commit to it. So I think that's the biggest recommendation I would have is, especially if you're at a CEO staff level job, I think you have to look at it as you have to be able to influence people that don't report to you, mm-hmm. to go execute on the strategy that's required to drive the outcomes.
Yeah.
Right. And I think the second is you have to be able to make informed decisions with limited information with absolute conviction. And that's where if you have a collective group of offering team leaders working together, you suss that out very quickly. That's the biggest advice I have. And the second is, I've never been a proponent, we talked about it earlier, of doing some type of pilot program. I have always traditionally leaned towards all in or all out.
Yeah.
And you have to be comfortable with that risk. But if you ultimately work for the CEO, the more work you can do in terms of setting the table for him or her, you'll get the support you need.
Yeah.
And then I think the third is, and this is just my style, is especially if you're working with your board or your CEO or other CEO staff members, rather than drop a big idea on them, I look at it as cookie crumbs. I typically will, if I have something very strategic I want to make a change on over a 2 to 3 week period, I'll drop cookie crumbs in terms of, hey, I've been thinking about this. I have an idea. We might want to explore this. And then over 2-3 weeks, you drop multiple little tidbits. And what you will find is ultimately then it becomes their idea. Somebody ultimately will stand up and say, hey, Eric, you've mentioned this. You might want to go explore that further.
Yeah.
Right? That's just my style.
That's it.
You know what? It works on me all the time. I think those are the pieces of advice I would give. And then lastly, look, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have things that don't go as planned, or you get rude surprises, and that is completely okay. That means you're working on the right problems.
Yep.
That are hard to solve. And then you've got to maintain conviction and a high degree of mental fortitude around it.
Yep.
And I would say any big sea change, you've got to be that barometer that when the highs are high and the lows are low, you don't vacillate that much.
Yep.
Because you're going to have times where people need affirmation, and you're going to have times where people need reassurance around, is what we're doing the right thing and in the best interest for me and for the organization?
Yeah. No, that's wonderful advice. Look, we've had a really rich discussion, and I think this has been wonderful. So we usually transition to a bit of a lightning round, which is more of a personal type of thing. So I'm going to limit it to two questions here.
Well, that's fine. I can take 10, whatever you want to do. Let's go.
What is the favorite part of your job?
Winning.
Love it. Love it. What is your least favorite part of your job?
Working on mundane activities.
Yeah. What do you like to do outside of work?
My kids are both grown, so otherwise I would say I'm herding cats. For me, I really enjoy the outdoors, so I'm a big runner.
Yep.
I play golf every weekend.
Me too.
Basically, any activity that gets the heart rate up, I really enjoy, and I try to invest as much as possible in my overall health.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Last question. Where do you turn for inspiration, right? So you're a leader of a good-sized company, but where do you turn for inspiration?
Man, that's a great question. I'm a curious person by nature. I'm fortunate that I've worked with a lot of great people over the last 20 years, some that are board level seats, some are CEOs and so forth. And so I have a small group of, I'll call it, thought partners that I leverage on a consistent basis. I don't know if that drives towards inspiration, but I always look for ways to improve. I always talk about 10% improvement in anything you do.
Yeah.
If I think about career and focus and are we doing the right things, it's just leveraging as multiple constituents as you can, have thought yeah. partner exercises with them and yeah. in terms of kind of rationalizing through issues. So that's the outlet for me. And then my wife, it's like whether it's your spouse or your kids, they tend to be great simplifiers. You yeah. drop a very complex issue or problem on them. They may not really understand what it is you do,
yeah.
but they typically can pinpoint one or two things
yeah.
that you stand back and it's just like, wow. It's like a six-year-old came up with that. So I do lean on Tracy a lot to just bounce ideas, and she's always been a great sounding board for me and been very supportive.
Yeah. Great. Well, listen, Eric, I appreciate this. This was probably one of my favorite episodes that I've done, and I've done quite a bit of them. So appreciate your candor, your openness to come on the show. I think
sure.
our audience is going to find a huge benefit from it. So next time I'm in Atlanta, I will look you up and maybe we'll grab a coffee or something.
Absolutely.
All right. That's another episode of the Revenue Lounge. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah. Thank you, Randy.